Hello everyone, welcome back. This is Chander in Palo Alto.
Hi, this is Arne in Oslo.
So we are back after Arne's 6-week vacation. He stayed in the Nordics. Well, any highlights, Arne, from your holiday?
Just being able to travel to a different country and being out and about was a great feeling.
Where did you go?
Denmark and west coast of Norway.
Okay, so for us in the US, it's all the same, you know, the Nordics.
It's kind of like going over the Santa Cruz Mountains. That's a different country.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, depending how you look at it, a lot has happened in last 6 weeks, or you can say, well, nothing has changed. Nothing has happened. So I thought today we cover some highlights from the summer, which is still going. We have a heat wave here in Palo Alto for the last few days. But in the tech world, the startup world, I think a few significant things have happened. So I thought we cover some of them since we want to keep a podcast less than an hour. So we'll cover five things today. One, what's happening in the stock market, the earnings from GAFA or Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon. That was the first quarter, they announced second quarter earnings. So that was the first quarter with full COVID effect. You know, the Q1 earnings only had March where the economy shut down, but this was the full quarter where COVID was happening. And third is SPAC, which is Special Purpose Acquisition Company. So that's a new way of companies to go public. At least on top of my head, I remember Nikola and the Virgin Galactic, they went public that way. And then fourth is the testimonies of big four companies, the one I mentioned, the earnings we'll discuss, Amazon, Apple, Google, and Facebook. Their CEOs were in front of the Congress to testify on anti-competitive behavior. And then fifth is, it's more big deal in the US, but I think the Nordic audience would find it interesting. The California ruling on Uber and Lyft regarding the government ordering these companies to reclassify their workers as employees. How does it sound, Arne?
Sounds great.
You think we can cover all this in 1 hour?
If we manage to speak fast or stay focused, we should be able to do it.
Okay, let's try. So let's start with the stock market. So in general, what's your view of what's happening in the market?
So I would say that the stock market is surprisingly strong relative to the true economic conditions of the world. So the stock market is riding high. It's kind of back up after the March dip. And tech indices are at all-time high. Mm-hmm. For sure.
I think S&P is above, it is at all-time high. Like, it's above
yes.
Where it was before COVID.
This is true. And it's also driven by the market caps of the large tech companies. So I think there's still a sort of a split between tech and the other stocks in the market. But it is surprisingly high on all levels, but particularly high on tech companies.
Yeah. And I think in our last episode, a few weeks ago, we discussed the reason mainly is there's nowhere else for the money to go. And also, it's working on the hypothesis that you know, things will get back to 80%+ of where they were in a few months. It may happen, it may not happen, but that's the hypothesis.
Yeah, so I think, you know, an interesting thing about tech driving this is essentially that what COVID has done is to essentially accelerate tech and digital transformation even further. So the world has been in this wave of digital transformation, well, of the enterprise, of, you know, the world going from brick and mortar retail to e-commerce, and just sector after sector of the economy transforming, and COVID just essentially accelerates that. It was sort of a 2-year acceleration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, I think e-commerce digitization is accelerating. So I note it down. Normally we don't do, or at least I don't do much homework for the podcast, but I wanted to be use this to be useful to others. So I noted down a few things which I found interesting that have happened in the stock market. So let me share them. Apple is now worth more than $2 trillion with a T. I think that's the first for a US company. I think Aramco may be the only one that is above $2 trillion or was above $2 trillion. But regardless, it's a big feat for, let's say, a business to be worth $2 trillion. I think in the list of countries, like if you measure GDP, this would be in top 12 in terms of the market cap.
Yeah. Yep.
Then it's, I think, to tag on to what Arne was saying, there's more digitization. So not only you have new e-commerce customers who are buying online first time, but there is more e-commerce. People who are buying before online are buying more of things online. Like Wayfair, Home Depot, all these, Target, Walmart. There's more and more online activity because, you know, people don't want to go out and it's convenient and you don't have to expose yourself to other people by being at home. Then this, I think, is unbelievable, the rise Shopify has seen. So it's 35x the stock price in 5 years. It's like above $1,000 now. It was like 28 when they went public in 2016 or 15. So 35x. So, you know, if you had invested, you know, $1,000 in Shopify at IPO, they would have been worth 35,000. So that's huge. And they are the ones, those of you who don't know Shopify, they have made doing e-commerce really easy, especially for small businesses and startups. You can go on their line and start selling stuff in like 10 minutes with your own brand.
Yes, so I think just Amazon and Shopify are the two winners in e-commerce the way the world looks now, and they're so different. In Amazon is the big, fully integrated platform, whereas Shopify is the enabler of all the long tail of independents.
Yeah, and Shopify also announced a deal with Facebook where they will help businesses on Facebook sell using Shopify. They're doing many things, like a marketplace, a Shopify app, but basically it's all helping small businesses sell online and also, you know, helping consumers to find good deals for what they're looking for.
Yep.
Then BigCommerce, which is a Shopify competitor, they went public a few days ago and they had 200% pop on the IPO, meaning I forget what it was priced at, but let's say it was priced at 100. So it opened at 200 or above 200. Then Airbnb filed for an IPO, regardless of their revenues being down with, you know, almost no travel. It's a confidential filing, so I don't think we'll have access to the S-1. Then Palantir also filed for the IPO, and they also announced they will leave Silicon Valley, the headquarters, and go to Denver. So their Denver will be the headquarters, which is, you know, big deal for Silicon Valley. If you live, I live in Palo Alto, like I would say half the downtown buildings are owned by or rented by Palantir. So they have big presence in Palo Alto. So there are many reasons for them to do that, but that's, you know, an episode in itself.
I think Airbnb and Palantir are sort of has been long time anticipated IPOs. I think Airbnb everyone has waited for pretty much since 2018, and then it looked like they were going this year, and then it looked like they weren't going this year, and now they're back on apparently. Whereas Palantir has sort of claimed they were going public or about to go public for more or less 4 years now. Mm-hmm. But it's a very controversial company. For people in Nordics, in that they do a lot of dirty work for the government that a lot of citizens are against. So they're a very controversial company, and their move to Denver is also along the lines of, look, we're not welcome in California anymore, so you know, we're leaving.
Yeah, and I'm sure they have good reasons, because it's a big deal for a company of that prominence to leave Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anything else you want to add on the stock market?
Yeah, I think, you know, you mentioned the pop of BigCommerce that was 200%. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, June, July, August have been sort of IPO poporama. I mean, there's been controversies around the pops that have gotten larger and larger and leaving, you know, shareholder value on the table. And this has been going on for maybe two last years, and it's been hotly discussed. But, you know, the craziness of it has truly come out in the last 2 months. And the level of the pop is just unbelievable. So the world is a bit out of order with respect to these things in the US just at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I think the investment bankers, they charge so much money. We'll cover that in the SPAC section. And like, they're so wrong and they get rewarded for being wrong. It makes no sense. But yeah, that's my view. Okay, let's look at the earnings of the big four. That's Google, Apple, Facebook, and Amazon. So in summary, I think you may have gathered from our stock market discussion, everything's positive for these companies. Like, it's, there was no surprise, they all beat expectations. I think one exception might be Amazon Cloud Business or AWS.
Google's cloud business would also, but marginally.
Yeah, I don't remember their expectation, but it was that was Google's first quarter since they went public, or maybe since they started, where the revenue decline happened. But that might have been expected. But it's still big news.
Yeah, when we say they beat expectations, all of them beat expectations and quite handily on earnings per share.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't all honky-dory on every front, because it was not like a straight continuous growth on all fronts for all companies. Mm-hmm. But on a relative scale, relative to what's going on in the world, it was great performance around the block, I would say.
Yeah. So let me share some numbers for these companies. Apple revenue, I think it's not their fiscal second quarter. I think
it's the third.
Third, yeah. But calendar year, it's second quarter. So the revenue was up year over year 11% to almost $60 billion in one quarter. And I think a lot of that happened with increased Mac revenue because people are working from home. So the companies are giving employees new laptops or they're buying them on their own. 60% of their business is international now. So they only make 40% in the US. Another big news from Apple was Phil Schiller, who's been their CMO for almost 30 years. So CMO slash, you know, in marketing roles for 30 years. He became a fellow and one of his deputies is now the CMO. Apple is paying dividends, which, you know, tells you they don't know what to do with all the money they're making. They also announced 4-to-1 stock split. So that helps more retail investors to get in. And services generated $13.2 billion last quarter. That's up 15% year over year. Anything you want to add on Apple, Arnon?
No, I'm quite just excited about the services business because like Apple's Achilles heel, if you like, has always been like, well, you know, they sell goods and what if people don't buy a new device this year? Their revenues will drop off significantly now. And people have sort of undervalued their services business. Opposite in Amazon, people have been very excited about AWS and the cloud offering they have. In reality, the services business, which is the truly recurring revenue business of Apple, is now almost a fourth of their revenue. And their services business is actually bigger than AWS.
So, sorry, say that again? Amazon services business?
In revenues are bigger than AWS revenue.
So AWS is Amazon Web Services. So how do you mean?
Apple's services business is bigger than AWS.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. So I think they are around 10, 11 billion and Apple is
13
point something billion. Yeah, AWS is smaller than Apple services revenue, but it's, you know, very different. AWS is B2B business, a lot of startups, little revenue, and Apple has billion device install base. So
still, the point is more that this has been an undervalued reality about Apple, their recurring services business, whereas everybody's been aware of AWS as this big asset of Amazon.
Yeah, it's just, you know, for a while they were growing organically or with device sale. I think the last few years they've started paying more attention. And the growth rate was something, you know, Amazon had it much bigger. Even in this quarter, they grew almost 30%. And Apple grew 15%. So I think people are excited about the growth rate. But Amazon now has real competition. Apple, not so much. Okay.
Yep.
Move on to Google.
Yeah.
So as we said earlier, this first ever year-over-year decline, the revenue was $38.2 billion. Search revenue is down. YouTube revenue is up. Cloud is around $3 billion now, which is still one-third or less than one-third of AWS cloud revenue. But compared to their previous year, it's up 33%. And they announced $28 billion worth of stock repurchase, so which also tells you they don't know what to do with the money. So they're returning it to shareholders.
Yeah. Yep.
Anything else on Google?
No, I mean, the stock market didn't really think this was particularly interesting. It sort of went flat after the announcement. I think, you know, the fact that a company drops in revenue that's been growing and growing and growing is a big news, although the circumstances are very particular around COVID. Yeah. And also the reports there is that it's picking up as semi-normalization sets in.
Yeah. So now I think people probably know this. Google reports revenue basically in like four categories. You have the search, the YouTube is reported separately now, which is also mainly advertising, and then cloud is third, and rest is other bets. Other bets is, you know, almost nothing, 100 something million. I love saying this, you know, 100 something million, almost nothing. When in startup world, you know, you would die for 100 million revenue. Yeah, other thing I noticed, this is more anecdotal. In Q2, the ad load on YouTube was much higher. Like, it's much more observable. Like, when you play YouTube videos, you see many more ads now than you did the previous quarter or before. I think that was to overcome the loss in advertising. And people are kind of at home, so they'll be more tolerant of ads because they have not much else to do. Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, let's look at Facebook, which announced, because Facebook is the, I would say, the company with the biggest number of customers in the world. They announced 1.75 billion daily active users. That means people use, these many number of people use their products daily. And products mainly here are Instagram, the Facebook app, and WhatsApp. And 2.7 billion monthly active users. And the ratio is consistent, you know, daily to monthly ratio is around 66%, which is a good thing. Then they introduced this metric a few years ago or a few quarters ago called daily active people, meaning if you look at all their properties, then how many unique people used one of the properties in a day or a month. The daily active people went up to 2.5 billion and monthly active people went to 3.1 billion. So 3.1 billion unique people used one of the Facebook products in a month. That's amazing. The revenue was 18.7 billion, like in the GAFA category, Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, they are the smallest. So you see here, their revenue was 18 billion, Apple was 60 billion, and Google was 38 billion. So they're, you know, relatively small comparatively. And almost all of it is advertising revenue. And that revenue was up 11% year over year. And their ARPU, which they, it's interesting, they report ARPU as quarterly. You know, in the world I come from, ARPU is generally monthly. But their ARPU per quarter was $6.10. And that amounts to like $2 a month. So all the time you spend on Facebook, Facebook makes $2 from all your time you spend on Facebook per month. The operating margin was 32%.
Yeah, I think the ARPU number, though, if you start drilling down to that, is very asymmetric from country to country.
Yeah.
And I don't have the number in front of me, but if you look at the US number, for example, it's, let's say, in the order of $50 per quarter.
Mm-hmm.
So like 10x the average of the world.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Eight to 10x, something in that region, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't remember the exact numbers, but I know there's a wide variation. Like ARPU in India is much lower than in the US.
Yeah.
In Africa. Okay, anything else on Facebook?
I think it's kind of interesting that their advertising revenue is growing while Google's is not in the same quarter, which essentially these two companies account for 2/3 of the ad revenue, certainly in the US. And also in same order of magnitude in other Western markets. So like on a relative basis, Facebook is winning.
Yeah, I think it's the nature of the product. So
yeah,
Google, the search revenue or ad revenue, is you have to be looking for that product. And people are looking less of those things. The Facebook revenue comes from things in your feed. The people are spending more time in your feed. So
yeah. And Google's revenue around search is typically around events of specific intent, whereas Facebook is more in an entertainment setting, which is, you know, when people have more time on their hands for some reason.
Yeah. Okay, now we come to Amazon, the biggest of all in terms of revenue. Their revenue last quarter was $90 billion, which is up 40% year over year. And out
it's
of
kind of nice to grow at that rate at that size.
It's unbelievable how they continue the growth. Yeah. Then they're out of that $90 billion. AWS was $11 billion, which is up 29% year over year. Operating income was $5.8 billion, which was up 90% compared to last year. So they also had a great quarter, and which, you know, shows in their stock price as well. I think moving forward, I see them facing more challenges in AWS. Google is getting their act together. Microsoft is, you know, has the enterprise market or big company market, and people are noticing the big bills. So there is more migration or halting of those bills.
Yeah. Okay. Just a comment. Obviously, the main driver for the revenue growth is obviously that acceleration of e-commerce that we talked about earlier in the episode.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to the next topic. Let's back. So, which is a new thing. I only learned about what it is and how it's used in the last 2-3 months. Were you aware of this vehicle before, Arne?
No, I was actually not. Although, you know, the vehicle has some commonalities with the SPV, although it's public. And apparently it's not a new thing. It's been around for a long time. It's just not really been used.
Yep. Yeah. How I would describe it is, you as an investor, you basically invest in a retail store, let's say, and you don't know what the store is going to sell. So you sell, you know, invest in an empty store, and then they decide what to sell. So basically, a company which is special purpose acquisition company lists on an exchange as a shell company. And then let's say Airbnb wants to go public using SPAC, then that shell company will merge with Airbnb. And that's how the Airbnb shares will be available for the public to trade. Anything I missed on the basic of what it is, Arne, you want to add?
I think that makes sense. It's also called a blank check company. It's essentially an empty company with money buying another company and through that listing it.
Yeah, and there's a lot more activity in this area. Bill Ackman, who's a famous investor, created a SPAC. Then this morning I read some other company created a SPAC. I think that's the new thing. A lot of people are creating SPAC. Now, why would people do that? Like, if I am a startup, I want to go IPO, why would I choose the SPAC route versus the normal IPO route? Yeah.
So we talked about IPOs before, and there was this whole thing about, you know, the pop, which in itself has been very contentious, right? So this is a way of avoiding the pop by having one negotiation. And in principle, if you have the asset to list, you could negotiate with multiple SPACs if those were available to get a fair price, which would be de facto the listing price. So that's one. The other is the fee structure. You know, bankers make a lot of money on IPOs. Mm-hmm. Now, there are other costs associated with SPAC, and they might not be all that different, but definitely costs are structured in a different way in a SPAC. Then there's the process of IPOing, which in itself is super painful. It is, you know, you have to produce a document to the SEC in the US. I mean, there are some differences from country to country, but let's take the US example. You have to produce an S-1 to the SEC. Mm-hmm. It has to be vetted through multiple stages, and there are all sorts of compliance things associated with that. And then you have to do a roadshow, and during all of this, all of this takes time. There are very strict limitations on what you can do and what you can say and what things you can do, and you don't ultimately know the result of it until the end. And by the time you get to the end, the whole world might have changed. Mm-hmm. So that sort of whole drag in time and effort and uncertainty is something, in principle, you could avoid by using a SPAC, because you do the sort of the paperwork and the complications before when it's an empty shell, and then the transaction itself becomes easier and shorter. So that's another reason for it. Mm-hmm. Finally, I think there are some other drivers at the table as to why the SPAC has become popular. One is that because of the structure of the IPOs the few years, there have been relatively few IPOs. Mm-hmm. And this could be a way of bringing more companies to the public market, possibly earlier. And actually, a lot of public market investors would like to have more companies to be able to invest in, because of the shift to the private markets in value creation have blocked these guys for being able to access that sort of value creation. And SPAC might be a tool to alleviate that. Mm-hmm. And finally, I think there is this thing where talent in the financial services industry have hit a more dry spell. I'm thinking about hedge fund managers and so forth, and are looking for new creative ways of making money. And mm-hmm. hence, they have turned to SPACs rather than hedge funds.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good explanation. I'll add a few things to it. Like, as a, you know, an entrepreneur or some, let's say you're ready to go public, which is a badge of honor. You made it. Your early investors want to get out. Generally, that's the driving reason. Early investors want to get out, or you need to raise more capital. So in the IPO process, the investment bankers take up to 7% of the money they raise, 7%. So it's, you know, a lot of money. And then their priority is the investors in the company, not you, because you're a one-time customer. IPO is a one-time thing. They want to offer a good deal to the regular investors, which are repeat customers. That's why you see the pop, because they can sell, let's say they price the offering at $10, and so their investors get the stock at $10, and then the actual market thinks it's worth $20. That's why you see the pop. So that, you know, also on principle, I feel like it's a racket. You basically have no control. You have to work with somebody who is taking advantage of you. And then you have this green shoe option, which means when you do the underwriting, 15% of the shares, the investment bank can sell at their discretion if the demand is high. So you're giving up, you know, more of the company at lower price because of this green shoe option. So the, like most of the entrepreneurs here, I think people generally don't like that, that they have no control over this whole process and you have to deal with all this. So the SPAC avoids all this. You know, you don't have to pay those fees. You're in control. They can manipulate you. And ironically, like if as a banker, your job is to price the company right, if it goes up, they're not punished. They're rewarded because the incentives are not aligned.
Yeah, so I think there are three things to say, and the first one sort of builds on what you say, and that's you know, the founders one-on-one investment bankers, mm-hmm. and that is you have to pay them mm-hmm. to represent you, and in reality they don't represent you, they represent the people with the money, because their vested interest is to make the people with the money happy. Mm-hmm. And they're incentivized for making transactions happen. And the people with the money are likely to have money the next time. And therefore, you pay them 2 to 10% or even more in the most ugly cases. And they don't represent you. They're incentivized by transactions. Mm-hmm. The other thing to say, though, is that a SPAC, and I don't pretend to have a lot of experience about something that I started hearing about a couple of months ago. But, you know, in the SPAC scenario, there's like somebody who's setting up the SPAC and doing the work and rigging it and promoting it and doing the transactions. These guys also get paid or have very high incentives in these guys. There might be more aligned incentives, mm-hmm. and there are also costs involved in the transactions, but there is a third party involved here, and that is not cost-free. It's just a question of whose pocket does that cost come out from. Mm-hmm. And the third thing to say is that why did it become unpopular when it was invented? And what are the risks now? Well, if you sign up for SPAC, even if it's a publicly traded instrument, who knows what the sponsor is going to do with the money and how transparent is the acquisition of whatever is being acquired, and are these forever going to be high quality unicorns that are going to go right to the sky? Probably not. So there is a risk that there's going to be some bad acting going on here as this small bubble is inflating, and who knows if it'll be a big bubble and how, what kind of bubble it will be.
Yeah, it's like I was saying earlier, you're investing in an empty retail store. You don't know who is going to, what they're going to sell.
I think it's worth mentioning that that sort of the driver for reinventing this vehicle is Chamath with a very difficult last name, who was the managing partner of Social Capital, who sort of famously 2 years ago melted down his venture capital firm and said venture capital is broken, and said I'll SPAC from now on, and people have followed suit.
Yeah, it's Chamath Palihapitiya.
Exactly. Yeah, thank you for helping out.
Social Capital, that's his venture firm.
Yeah.
So we'll see, you know, how these things evolve, but I think it's good for entrepreneurs that there is another option now, which is always good. Previously, there weren't many options. And I still don't know why more companies don't go the Google route where they do the auction. I don't know. And even in SPAC case, how do you determine the valuation? Do you know? Like how?
The valuation is more or less an M&A negotiation.
Yeah. So it's not, yes. So it's, you know, somebody's opinion. It's not market deciding.
That's true.
Yeah. So we'll see how it evolves, but I think it's good that entrepreneurs have options.
Yeah, I also don't think this is, you know, this is not for a seed company from Norway flying to Silicon Valley to raise money. That's not what the SPAC is for. For entrepreneurs, it's still a reasonably mature company by the time you get to this point.
Yeah. Okay. Any
and I think generally, you know, having multiple options and multiple routes to pursue is a good thing. Mm-hmm. However, I also think that as something like this evolves, it's immature and it remains to be seen how well it's working.
Yeah, we'll find that out. I mean, Bill Ackman, you know, recently became famous again for making a lot of money during March. He's like a lot of big names are doing this now. He's just one of them. There are many other options. So as you said, we'll see how it evolves. But overall, it's a good thing for startup people.
And I think what I read on like a sort of short version on Twitter last week was all VCs are doing SPACs and all angels are doing rolling funds these days. I think that's a very Silicon Valley statement. And in reality, I think if you list the SPACs and look at the distribution of them, they're generally a high percentage of hedge fund people from New York.
Yeah. Okay, shall we move on to the testimonies in summer?
Absolutely. Testimonies for Congress. Yeah. No less.
So basically, people who are not following the government is unhappy that these big companies have a lot of power and they want to do something about it.
Ultimately, they're old politicians in Washington who suddenly one day woke up and say, wait a minute, are there people who are more powerful than us? That cannot be allowed.
Yeah. So do you want to say more? Like why? That's more, let's say, probably emotional reason for them to do it. But what is the business societal reason for them to pursue these companies?
Well, I mean, there's some half truth to everything and half half politics to all of it. But like the case they have is abuse of market power, you know, abuse of pricing power, and interference with societal work, so to speak. That's like the main idea here, and that also involves like how they acquire companies and monopolistic trading and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so there has been like an FTC DOJ investigation into tech companies. They're reviewing all the acquisitions they did over the last 10 years. I went to like a meeting at Stanford that Stanford Law School organized with they were probably DOJ representatives, government people, and Silicon Valley people to see, you know, to discuss the issue. you can tell in 10 minutes. They have no, you know, generally they don't understand how the business world works. Like they complain about Facebook bought Instagram because they saw them as threat. Yeah. So what? So why? It's free market economics. You know what? If I see I can increase my revenue, earnings, better shareholder returns, why can't I buy a startup which currently has no revenue? Who knows in what direction they will go? But I don't see anything wrong with Facebook buying Instagram at that stage. And nobody forced them. The Instagram people decided to sell the founders. And they made a lot of money, people who took the risk. The investors made a lot of money who took the risk. So I still don't understand what exactly is wrong with that.
Yeah, and I think the level of suspicion here is a little bit above what is normal. So if they had bought, if Instagram was like an on par competitor, they bought them and closed them down, I would sort of understand that. But Instagram at the time had a few tens of millions of users, much smaller. They didn't close them down. They actually invested heavily in it. And from a business perspective, it's one of the best investments ever. The yep. return on investment of buying Instagram is a fantastic business decision.
Exactly.
So, I mean, how, you know, it's not like predatory behavior, it's good business sense.
Exactly. And if you, let's say they pass a regulation that that's big companies cannot buy any startups, how will that change your investment thesis or strategy, Arne?
Yeah, I mean, if it, you in general outlaw it, that would be problematic. The bread and butter of venture capital is M&A. Even if, you know, you hope you have a Google or a Facebook in your portfolio that IPOs and becomes a $1 trillion company. But on a statistical basis, the bread and butter is great M&A.
Exactly. So, I mean, the consequences are so big, which are not good for society, for investors, entrepreneurs. If they make it difficult that big companies cannot buy small companies, you know, money will go out of venture capital. And then it'll become harder to raise money, less people will do startups. And that means less innovation, less jobs. I mean, it's bad. But somehow that's a hard concept for the government people to understand.
And it also turns out that it's a great thing for society for multiple reasons, because it creates growth and jobs. Because large companies are particularly good at scaling big things, whereas small companies are good at innovating and moving fast. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the big differences between the U.S. economy and success of fast-growing companies in the U.S. is that they're very good at acquiring and building bigger companies based on acquisitions. The European industry is not as good at that and is suffering for it. Yeah. Not that I'm saying that all M&A is successful in the US. It's a risky approach anywhere, but the best companies are really, really good at it. And that's good for GDP and growth and employment.
Yeah. Even if the acquisition, let's say, fails, it doesn't meet the internal targets, projections, it is still good for the ecosystem and society, because the entrepreneur gets rewarded, the investor gets rewarded, the cycle continues. You know, people do startups, investors invest, the cycle continues. If nobody gets acquired, the cycle will stop or, you know, slow down significantly. But I would say this time the Congress was much better prepared than last time. So they did this a few years ago where they were asking basic things like, oh, how do you make money to Zuckerberg? So this time they were more well prepared. They were asking, you know, I wouldn't say right questions, but they were asking, they were not asking any trivial questions.
Yeah. I still think it was a show. A couple of interesting things to notice. One was, since COVID-19, I've been on 15 different conferencing solutions. And the only one I haven't been on was the one they used there, and that was WebEx. The other was that whoever did the PR work of the tech CEOs, mm-hmm. have done their work to make them look like innocent little schoolboys and not like evil masterminds taking over the world. So there was some staging of how they looked, that's for sure.
Yeah, so I think the hearing was at the Senate. I'm saying Congress, that includes both houses, but this hearing was at the Senate, the last one, yeah?
Yeah.
But I feel it was more of a show, because if you really wanted to get deeper, you would invite them one by one. So by four of them together, nobody got the heat. You know, it was like an industry versus tech versus government, rather than, you know, Google versus government or Apple versus government. So that's all staged, you know, or maybe I'm too cynical, but it seemed more like a show. I don't know what will come out of this, but I don't expect much coming out of this.
And another thing I say is worthwhile is that Bezos is, or whoever writes for Bezos, is really good at writing. So the shareholder letters Bezos writes are really worth reading.
Yeah.
And once again, for this hearing at Congress, the companies, you know, had written statements. Mm-hmm. And Bezos once again used that ability to write, mm-hmm. as a clear marketing opportunity. Once again, that's the written statement that got circulated, and everybody said, well, look at what these guys are doing. They're fantastic.
Yeah. And I mean, all consumers like these companies. Like, imagine your life without Google, Apple, Facebook, Amazon. Like, we use them almost daily.
I live in Norway, and life without Amazon is much harder than it used to be. Yeah. But that's set to change in a year.
So it's more, I think, how they treat other businesses. I don't know what the complaint, what exactly are they trying to solve? Like, breaking them won't change anything. Also, they don't realize, so I did marketing, you know, before we had targeted advertising, like we have with Facebook now or with Google, where you use somebody's data to target them. I mean, as a marketer, your life is much easier. The companies can, you know, get much more value out of advertising dollar if they're using Facebook, and Google, versus if the only option was print advertising in newspaper versus mailing flyers at home versus TV ads. The startups won't be able to do anything. It's a lot of what's possible today is because of these targeted ads. Of course, they should protect the data. They should have, you know, not misuse the data, all that. You know, they can solve by having tighter regulation on data protection. I think Europe is leading there. But, you know, blindly targeting companies, they use data for advertising. Yeah, that is the whole idea. If you want to ban targeted ads, it will have these ripple effects on the economy, where it'll be much harder to acquire customers. There'll be less startups who will do well. It'll be a big company thing. Who can only afford to, you know, go to TV or have print ads, or are in a position to waste money, where you want to target 100 people and you have to advertise to, you know, 10,000 people to target those 100.
Targeting is just efficiency.
Yeah.
That said, I mean, I don't want to sound like a complete fan and without any critical view on any of these companies. I think there are true difficult and practices from some of these companies that are worth criticizing. I'm probably most critical of Facebook and their role in spreading information in particular ways. So I don't think they're without issues, any of these companies. But I think the people in Congress are certainly not the ones who are able to solve those problems.
Yeah. So we'll see if anything comes out of that. But it was a big thing in the Valley in summer that the four CEOs showed up there. And I saw an interview with Bill Gates. They asked him about this. They said, oh, at least there were four. When he was fighting that, he was all alone. He had to fight the same battle. But, you know,
I think at least they stepped up.
Huh?
At least they stepped up to the level where none of them wanted to look like the biggest idiot on earth this time around. And I think that's at least what they managed to, I mean, of the senators. You know, they tried to avoid to ask those questions like they did last time.
Yeah. So talking of government interfering with businesses, you want to talk about the California ruling on Uber and Lyft?
Yeah, so California has had this thing going for a little while. I guess it started with something called California Assembly Bill 5 or AB 5 in 2019, essentially putting down a new law about how you had to employ people in the gig economy. And this has sort of rolled on, and now it's to the level where it's concluded that Uber and Lyft and companies like that have to change the status of their what was viewed as contractors to being employees and with the responsibilities that entail. And that now seems to come to a point where Uber and Lyft have to take action, and the action they're seem that they will be taking or threatening to take is to say, well, we simply can't operate in California anymore.
So it's tricky, I think, here also. Sorry, I was looking up if the hearing was Senate or Congress. So it was Congress. Some I thought it was with the Senate. But regardless, one of the houses.
Well, I think it was Senate. That's also Congress. It was not, Congress is made out of the Senate and the House of Representatives.
Yes, so, but generally, when people say Congress, they mean House of Representatives. But it was one of those two. That's not important. So I wanted to make sure we are not giving up wrong information. So it was one of those two. I don't remember which one. Yeah. So sorry, I was distracted, Arne. So, like, if you look at the sharing economy, there are 55 million gig workers. And here also, government and businesses are kind of intertwined. And 55 million gig workers in the US, that's 34% of the workforce. So now they want these two companies, Uber and Lyft, to reclassify their employees as, workers as employees. So their argument is it's a platform. We are matching, you know, like somebody who has an asset that he or she can use to offer you a service. It's like eBay. the buyers and sellers on eBay, they're matching buyers and sellers. Similarly, Uber and Lyft are matching buyers and sellers of rides. So why should they be treated different than eBay? I see the argument, like if they're not employees, then the burden is taken by society. So the society has to provide them with healthcare or unemployment benefits, so they don't get sick leave. So I'm empathetic to, you know, people who work in these jobs. But the solution is, which is not easy, to have nationalized healthcare. So you take that out of employers. In the US, it is, you know, employer generally provides your healthcare. So if the employer is not providing it, then you have to pay out of pocket, which is really expensive. To get an idea, like for me to have same coverage as provided by my employer, as a single person, it's like over $1,000 a month, $1,000 a month, just healthcare insurance for one person. So that's a big expense. So I think here they're kind of mixed, what the society wants and what the employer wants. But I am more on the side of employer. I mean, now imagine your life without Uber and Lyft. I don't think they would have become successful if they had to classify every driver as an employee, because then you have to track the shifts. You can't go in and out. Today, people can go in and out to drive whenever they want. So the pool, the California pool, the data may help see the point. You have around 200,000 drivers in California with Uber, and less than 2% drive more than 40 hours a week. And Uber has 300,000 drivers in California, and more than 86% of them drive less than 20 hours. So you see, most people are doing it on the side. So why create something that, you know, is not helpful to 86% of the people? I think the solution is more the government has to provide benefits to these people, which currently in the current system they cannot.
I think this is a very complex issue, and it varies from country to country. And I think it also is difficult because the labor force of contractors is very heterogeneous. You have people who it's truly a part-time thing as an add-on, and they want flexibility. They don't want being responsible to show up and drive at certain times, whereas others, this is the primary income. And you have to make sure that they have decent conditions in their life. And so it's a very complex issue. I think this is somewhat different if you look at the Nordics or in other countries as to what is already in place and what is fair and what, but it's also probably regulated very differently. Mm-hmm. I think, though, the whole thing is probably potentially a watershed in the whole development of the gig economy, and implications of what can you provide and under what circumstances. I don't think it necessarily is critical that they need to be classified as employees, as long as you can classify it as a flexible and part-time employment, and you just bundle the responsibility into that. I think the key here is a flexibility issue, and the fact that you need to bundle what's appropriate into it, as long as there are no safety net in society.
Yeah, I think that's probably the biggest point, safety net in the society. is not there in the US. Society, I think, with a country as rich as the US, should have that.
Yeah, so I think I'm still somewhat bullish on the platforms. I'm not sure if gig economy is the right term for it. But the reason why I think, I mean, Uber and Lyft and similar services are great as a consumer user experience. Yep. But it's also actually good for the resources if the terms are right, because it's more efficient in allocating resources, and it has an added flexibility both ways. And this is also a value to the suppliers in this system. And as long as there's a reasonable share and cost allocation of it, I think that can be solved by a platform and a technology here. But it's the distribution of that. And I think there's this friction point of making that happen, but I don't see that, you know, going away from these platforms is the solution, because everybody loses.
Yeah, exactly. So they, Lyft announced this morning that they're going to stop operating at midnight today, because I think the deadline is tomorrow for them to reclassify. We'll see. Their main strategy is to basically, in California, we have direct democracy, meaning if you get enough signatures, you can put that measure for a ballot by the constituents. So that's what they're trying to do. Get it on the ballot in November, then people can vote. And that will overrule any previous law the state government passed. So that's what they're currently working on. We'll see if they succeed. Yeah.
It'll be exciting to see tomorrow. And maybe by the time people listen to this, this is all concluded in some other way.
Yeah, and they are exploring, I read yesterday, other options like rent a fleet, like get a company where they are the ones getting the fleet of cars, and they do a deal with that other company that manages, operates everything, so they don't have to classify, then the workers are working for this fleet company. They're exploring very creative options. We'll see how it pans out, but I think I'm more on the Uber Lyft side. At the same time, I think the government should do something for the people who work part time or who don't get benefits from the employers, because I'm empathetic to them. Like somebody. They should get it from society. What's your view? You are more on, you agree with that? All right.
I think it's okay if people are classified as employees and you bundle the cost of employing people into it. I think what is important is that the flexibility of the platform is retained. But I think there's a very strong supply and demand system into that, so it's a benefit to all. So I think that would work.
It depends, you know, what does employee mean? You have to have 8-hour shifts, provide breaks, and then people are getting paid even if they, you know, are not getting a ride, and it's a down day. And in suburbs where you get lower rides, there will be less drivers. Then they will hire, you know, less drivers to increase or decrease their expense. You have to have, you know, systems to monitor all this.
There are multiple ways of providing employment contracts with flexible work terms.
So I think that's what they are aiming for in the November ballot, to have a new class of employees where they pay them per, I think, 30 cents per mile, or there's something there for them. But, you know, having an employee comes with a lot of obligations in California. So if they do all that, then instead of, let's say, 200,000 employees in California, or not employees, workers, drivers on the platform, they may have, you know, one fourth of that. Then the cost will go up significantly. Then people will take less rides, or they may use other modes of transportation. So it's a very nuanced issue, but I think the it's a platform matching buyers and sellers.
Yeah.
That should be the premise it should operate under. Because then I can take this to eBay, I can take this premise to Airbnb. You know, I'm making money by doing this, and I should be treated as an employee. It's my full-time job. I'm an eBay seller.
Yeah, but I think this is a slightly drawn-out point, but you don't have to employ everyone full-time, and you employ people according to demand. And I'm just saying that the fact that you don't want to pay for employment or health benefits is just a cost issue. And I think you can just bundle health into it. And make people pay the real cost of transport.
Yeah, and it's then people will have to commit to working X number of hours. That takes away the flexibility. Like Starbucks provides benefits to part-time employees. I forget what they are, if they get healthcare or not. But I remember they were one of the first companies to provide, I think, education benefits, like 401k maybe, like regular employee benefits to part-time employees, which they were one of the first companies to do that. But they could have shifts, just as not as much flexibility was required. People could commit to working certain times a day, every day. But we'll see. It's very interesting to watch.
Well, I'm on a general opinion that the world is no longer 8 to 4 or 9 to 5 or whatever it is, wherever you are. I think the world is generally more flexible. And I think everyone, regardless of what employment is, should be working more flexibly and have the opportunity to work more flexibly. That just doesn't mean that you shouldn't have healthcare.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. The solution is, you know, universal healthcare. That's I don't see that happening short term, but I think that's the real, if the government can provide these two things, universal healthcare and universal basic income or unemployment benefits, so that nobody starves to death or dies because they can't get medical treatment. I mean, that shouldn't happen in a rich country.
Fully agree.
Yeah. Okay. On that note, we should end here. So for the next week, you want to tell everybody about our plan for next week, Arne? You can probably describe it better than I can, the Bifrost talks.
Yeah, so Nordic Innovation House in Silicon Valley, based out of Palo Alto, run these webinars reasonably frequently, and particularly throughout the COVID situation. I've been on those webinars a couple of times to talk about venture capital investment and so forth. We've been invited to kick off the fall series of their Bifrost talks, and so that will be sort of a crossover episode where we do our Valley Nordic episode as part of the Bifrost talks next Thursday. So it will both be a sort of a live video session with Bifrost talks, and then the recording of it will also go as our weekly episode of Valley Nordic.
Yeah. Thanks, Arne. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
Okay, see you. Bye.